Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Julian Assange of WikiLeaks was granted bail again in a British court today. That's the legal face of battle between governments and information leakers. Then there's the cyber front. Attacks all over on WikiLeaks by its opponents on MasterCard, Visa, PayPal, Amazon, the Swedish government, Dutch police, Joe Lieberman, and Sarah Palin by hacker defenders. It's been called the first real info war. New combatants, new causes, new means, and it's no joke, this hour on Point InfoWar, and what we've learned from the WikiLeaks confrontation. You can join the conversation, states and citizens taking each other out online over information. Can this really be happening? Can it get worse? And whose side will you be on if this gets uglier? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. We'll hear in this hour from former U.S. Director of National Intelligence, John Negroponte, who says it's time for battle stations. Joining me now from San Francisco is John Perry Barlow. He's a founder of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, a champion of Internet and information freedom, famously a former lyricist for the Grateful Dead, a fellow at Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society. He's in the thick of it. He's a cyber libertarian activist who 2 weeks ago tweeted the following message: the first serious info war is now engaged. The field of battle is WikiLeaks. You are the troops. And we've seen at least a piece of that battle. John Perry Barlow, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm okay. What have we just seen here, John?
Well, we've seen the equivalent of Lexington in the... I think that first tweet was kind of like the tweet heard around the world, and we are engaged in a conflict that I've anticipated for 20 years, and now I think is, as I say, fully engaged. The powers that have been, the powers of the industrial states, are really up against whether or not they're going to be able to exert sovereignty over cyberspace, and if they are, then I think the future of the human mind as a collective consciousness is probably in doubt.
I want to look at those principles and those stakes, John, but when you look at this confrontation, conflict, shot heard around the world, and the skirmish or battle or fighting that has followed, the Bull Run or Lexington here, what do you see as the most important steps in that? We've heard a lot about, you know, hacker defenders of WikiLeaks shutting down, at least temporarily, with denial of service, sort of overload MasterCard and Visa and PayPal and going after others. But what do you see as a, you know, you know this stuff. What's been most important in the blow for blow here?
Well, I think what's really most important is the fact that suddenly the truth is considered criminal and lies are protected speech. The government is revealing itself to be afraid of having its internal processes visible to the electorate. And I think that's actually critically important. We've been conducting an increasingly secret form of government in the United States. And now I'm afraid that they're going to have to either bargain with transparency or they're going to have to come up with a way to beat us.
Take us to the fight itself. Julian Assange headed out today, but with an ankle bracelet on, passport gone, checking in every day. He's still essentially a ward or a captive of the state. What about the cyber battle that we've seen? Is this kid stuff? Is it a big deal? If people, you know, what about the attack on WikiLeaks on the internet, not just in court?
It's really problematic because I personally and neither does the Electronic Frontier Foundation, I don't condone distributed denial of service attacks. I don't think that the answer to censorship is more censorship, which is what those amount to. But the problem that the forces on our side have is that if they use primarily defensive means, which are the ones that I'm proposing, to make certain that WikiLeaks can't be shut down and simply leave it at that, they don't make the press. And the second they invoke a denial of service attack, it's on the front page of the New York Times. So, you know, in many ways, the press is responsible for this by virtue of the fact that they report these kinds of attacks, and otherwise the story's dead.
But it's not just a headline. I mean, it is disruption of a business of big companies getting their attention, saying don't knock the blocks out from underneath WikiLeaks, and if you do, there's a price to pay, isn't it?
That's true. But I mean, it's not as if Visa or MasterCard were in a position to release Julian Assange. I think that you have to assign blame where it's due. And you can't just be randomly striking out at various powerful forces.
What about the cyber elements of the counter push against WikiLeaks? What have you seen there with your knowing eye? I mean, they went after people who were hosting them, Amazon and others, to take them off there. But is this sort of hacking all one way here? Are there state hackers at work, pushing back?
The original attack was also DDoS on the WikiLeaks site, which
caused, is overloading it so it basically crashes.
Exactly. So, but it was also in the process overloading a lot of the other sites that a company called EveryDNS was conducting domain name service for. So they had a legitimate interest in bumping WikiLeaks off their service. I don't think they were forced to by the government, and I actually don't think that the original attacks on WikiLeaks were governmental in origin. But nor do I think, for that matter, that Amazon was pressured by the United States government, nor Visa, nor MasterCard, nor PayPal.
You don't think so, despite calls from, let's say, Joe Lieberman's office or whatever went on there?
Joe Lieberman is a private citizen. I mean, he may be a United States senator, but
that's some kind of private citizen. That's a pretty exalted status.
I think the real problem is that in the what I'm starting to refer to as the media terror complex, large organizations view their interests as being completely parallel with those of the United States government, and they're willing to do things that are censorious on behalf of the government without even being asked. And this is also one of the things we're seeing written large here, is the fact that the internet is largely in private hands. And you know when you're dealing with a venue that's being provided to you by a private interest, you don't have rights as might be described by the Constitution. You have terms of service, and most people don't even read them when they click through. But those terms of service may be extremely censorious.
John Perry Barlow, stand by. We are going to hear in this hour from Ambassador, former Deputy Secretary of State, former Director of National Intelligence, John Negroponte. But joining us right now from Bloomington, Indiana, is Fred Cate. He's director at the Center for Applied Cybersecurity Research, distinguished professor of law at Indiana University, also a member of the Academy of Sciences Committee on Technical and Privacy Dimensions of Information for Terrorism Prevention and Other National Goals. Big, long title. Fred Cate, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
What do you make of the actual tit-for-tat, the blow-for-blow that we've seen in this so-called info war to this point, Fred? Is this serious stuff? Is this a little skirmish? Is this bull run or just what is it?
Well, I guess I would say two things. One is it looks to me a little bit more like a skirmish at this point rather than Lexington and Concord. The second thing is, of course, we don't know. It may turn out to be something more significant. But we've certainly seen info wars before, to use that terminology. And so far, most of this war has not been fought in cyberspace. It's being fought in a British courtroom.
That's pretty traditional legal action. It's over high principle, as John Perry Barlow sees it. I mean, what about the denial of service stuff and that piece of it here, the hacker defenders coming out? Do you see that as serious or kid stuff? I mean, is it on the same par as the Stuxnet that apparently went after Iran's nuclear program, or patty cake?
Well, so far, I would say it's on the lower end of the spectrum. I mean, let me say I'm enormously sympathetic to almost everything John Perry has said. And I think it's important to remember that the internet's an environment in which, if you will, citizens can fight back, that we're not quite as powerless as we are in other parts of our lives. But having said that, I mean, none of these attacks actually brought down any of the institutions they sought to attack. They may have inconvenienced some websites or some people wanting to visit those websites. And in fact, it was a strategy that at least WikiLeaks seems to have abandoned almost as soon as it started, saying it would prefer to just ensure that its information is mirrored around the world so that it remains available, rather than to engage in an offensive warfare against other institutions that are interfering with that goal.
Do you agree with John that the attacks on WikiLeaks online are not government-sponsored? That's his guess or assessment. What's yours?
Well, you know, I would share that guess, but again, highlighting the fact that it is a guess. I mean, at this point, the government is, in terms of going after Julian Assange, doing just fine. In terms of dealing with the information that it probably erroneously classified to start with, and certainly erroneously protected, or we would not have let one private walk out of an installation with all of that information. And now that it's trying to sort of reel back in those secrets, of course, it's fighting a hopeless battle in that sense. It's not a new battle, though. It's a battle the government's lost many times before.
Does this ratchet up? Does this turn into, you know, really significant online and otherwise attacks and counterattacks here? Or is this a fizz in a bottle and gone?
Well, I guess I would say I don't think it's either. The thing to remember is cyberspace is a remarkably insecure place to start with. And we know it's used for all sorts of nefarious purposes, some of them very local, internet fraud, phishing, scams, some of it very international, where we see cyber attacks, we see cyber espionage, stealing information that really matters. This is an important incident that's going on, but compared against all the other things that go on every day, I doubt if this is going to be the major news story a month from now.
You're sympathetic to John Perry Barlow's view. Aren't you also a security consultant to the Pentagon?
I do security consulting with both the Pentagon and Homeland Security.
This is really interesting. Hold that thought, Fred. And John Perry Barlow, please stand by. We're looking at the world's first InfoWar, if that's what it is, was. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the world's first info war, if that's what it is, if that's what it was, and what we just learned from the WikiLeaks confrontation. John Perry Barlow joins us from San Francisco, a founder of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. He sort of put out a call to cyber arms a couple of weeks ago, and we've seen a lot going on that front, not least Julian Assange ending up off the cyber charts in jail. Bail today, but still that ankle bracelet. He's still effectively under the control of the state in the UK. We'll see what happens there. Fred Kate joins us from Bloomington, Indiana. He's done classified work for the Pentagon on national security. He's director of the Center for Applied Cybersecurity Research at Indiana University. We're going to hear in just a moment from Ambassador John Negroponte, who was U.S. Director of National Intelligence. Let's go right to our listeners. Omaha, Nebraska. Todd, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
I agree that the government should keep certain things secret or should have the ability to keep things secret, but I heard a number that there's something like more than 2 million people on the sort of the secure government internet. How can there be any accountability or ability for the government to keep things secret with that level of dispersion of the information?
It's an awful lot of people who are on that, who had capacity to read, to get a hold of it, and an awful lot of people have. What should happen now, though, Todd? I mean, if there's a confrontation over this freedom, now that it's out there, what side do you come down on?
Well, I think once the genie's out of the bottle, you can't put it back in. But I also think there's got to be ways to keep the genie from getting out of the bottle in the first place. I'd be interested to hear from your experts how that happens.
Todd, thanks for your call in Omaha. John Perry Barlow, what exactly are you saying here? Throw away the whole idea of security, of top secret and all the rest. Just lay it all out there right now, or else, you know, the cyber world will come and get it. What are you saying?
First of all, it's worthwhile pointing out that very little of this was even secret, let alone top secret. I'm not opposed to the idea that the United States government should have some confidentiality in its diplomatic relations, nor in its military operations. But we have veered dramatically away from a condition where those secrets are being kept for practical reasons having to do with policy, and more towards having a government that is embarrassed to have the people know the truth. You know, chances are, if you don't want people to know about something, it's because you're probably doing something you oughtn't be.
Maybe it's just the day-to-day, down and dirty. I don't know. That can mean all kinds of things, we have learned, of dealings between nations who have interests and difficulties, and you're not sympathetic to that.
Well, not really. I've got to say, most of what was revealed, I mean, it has to be proven to me so far that any of these leaks, you know, in the whole history of WikiLeaks, has resulted in a single casualty. Now, there may be some embarrassment on the part of the United States government, which there really ought to be, and there may be some embarrassment on the parts of people like the leadership in Saudi Arabia or Yemen or Pakistan or Afghanistan. But, you know, I'd say that's qualitatively different from something that genuinely harms the national interest.
And you called it the first serious info war. Was there a winner? Where does this go? Where does it go from here?
Oh, I don't think we know who the winner is going to be. I think that both sides are extremely committed. There's a lot on the line. I mean, I think that this comes down to really assuring a new human right, which has never been promulgated before and never been possible, which is the right to know. And on the other side, you have a government that is absolutely determined to see that the people don't and can't. So, you know, both sides, I think, are equally committed to winning this, and I expect that there's going to be escalation, fairly radical escalation as this continues.
We're going to hear in just a moment from John Negroponte, who's got a kind of counter view on that point. Fred Kate, if there's a battle over this new right to know, as John Perry Barlow would put it, who's got the firepower? Who's got the troops? I mean, states and governments are big, but we've seen Anonymous and Project Payback and, you know, hits at people who cooperated with the government here. Who's got the firepower if this is a confrontation, Fred?
Well, I think what we're seeing is everybody's got the firepower now. So if you go back 40 years, the government's long been trying to keep secrets and trying to keep the press from publishing them. And historically, the government has only relied on courts to do that. So we had the Pentagon Papers case in which the government asked the Supreme Court, would it ask get the New York Times and the Washington Post to not publish data that, as it turned out, was just embarrassing. It didn't reveal national security secrets. Now, 40 years later, we're looking at, frankly, exactly the same issue being raised, but with a different medium. Now, the government has more tools at its disposal. But similarly, the people who want access to that information and the people who want to provide it also have more tools. And so I suspect we're going to continue to see more and more, as John Perry says, an escalation of this kind of tit-for-tat use of the technology in an effort to get it out there and also to block access. There's no question in my mind but what, in the long run, the internet is going to aid the forces that want the information out there because, as your caller said, it's almost impossible to reel it back in. All you need is one website, and it's out there forever.
So game on, war on, or info war on maybe here. Fred Kate in Indiana, John Perry Barlow in San Francisco, please stand by. Joining us right now from Washington is John Negroponte, big-time career U.S. diplomat who worked everywhere from Saigon to Manila to Tegucigalpa to Baghdad, was deputy U.S. Secretary of State, U.S. ambassador to the U.N., was enmeshed in controversy over hardball U.S. policy in Central America in the Sandinista and Contra years, after 9/11 named U.S. Director of National Intelligence. He is now in the private sector, a lecturer at Yale University, a partner at McClarty Associates, international risk analysis firm. Ambassador Negroponte, welcome. Thank you very much for being here.
Hello. Thank you.
What do you think should happen with those who have put the information out and who perhaps are defending getting that information out now?
Yeah, well, maybe a little background first, because I spent a lot of my life writing telegrams of the kind that
cables.
Are...
Cables.
Mm-hmm. Now, cables, we call them, mm-hmm. telegrams, thousands of them, because I was a political officer. I was a reporting officer, did a lot of analysis. I mean, first of all, that kind of reporting is kind of the basis for a lot of our diplomatic and national security decisions, and also input to the various analyses that are done back here in Washington about the security problems that we confront. Secondly, I mean, diplomatic relations, particularly in an increasingly independent, interdependent world, mean that we need friends around the world more and more, so that if you start publishing confidential telegrams about conversations that you've had with important counterparts around the world, that's going to gratuitously offend them. We don't want to that's a good way to lose friends and lose influence around the world. So, you know, when John Perry Barlow says, I'm not aware of any casualties, I think you're going to see casualties. You're going to see a reluctance on the part of foreign leaders to confide in us as we seek to advance our purposes around the world. Lastly, on the question of the background of this kind of information, I mean, it's for a reason that we have rules in the State Department that classified communications of this kind usually don't get declassified for 25 or 30 years after the events, mm-hmm. and not 3 or 4 days, as seems to have been happening lately. So, and I don't think the stuff that's come out in any way suggests cover-ups or wrongdoing by our diplomats. One of my friends jokingly said, our diplomats are being proven to be serial truth-tellers.
So you've got a fundamental
disagreement. And better writers than I would have expected, by the way.
Yeah, okay. Well, there you go.
John concedes. So you've got a fundamental disagreement over whether we ought to be going here in an age when information can flow very easily and very quickly. I mean, John says a fundamental human right to know, a new human right, the right to know. And you're saying, no, there's business of state to be done here, and it can't all be out in public 2 minutes after.
But I think both notions can be accommodated. If you look at the efforts that are made by the State Department, the White House, and others to inform the public of what's going on, you'll see, I mean, we have a fantastic website. We have daily press conferences. We publish a lot of material. I mean, an effort is made to go as far as we can in informing the public of what's going on and what our thinking is, but at the same time, protecting these essential relationships in such a way that they continue to exist and we continue to be able to exchange information with foreign governments.
Look, let me ask you this,
Somebody would have had to read the State Department's website for a long time before they would have found out that the State Department had instructed its staff to let the vice president of Afghanistan into the Emirates with $52 million in cash.
Till the cows came home, it never would have happened. Let me ask you this. John Negroponte, despite you're saying they put some stuff out there, that's a long way from instant transparency. I do see a fundamental disagreement here. You've got folks in your corner who would say, you know, let's go, you know, knock these guys down. The national interest cannot sustain this kind of transparency. John Perry Barlow's got troops in his corner saying, let's get it out there. It's a right to know. And if it comes to a power play between these two visions, John Negroponte, Ambassador, who wins?
Well, I think the government will take... first of all, I don't think there's a right to instant transparency
in certain
matters with respect to classified material, mm-hmm. which is protected by law, incidentally.
Understood.
Voted by the representatives of the people of the United States. Mm-hmm. So I don't think there's that right. I think as far as the stuff that's already been put out there, clearly it's going to keep dribbling out. So it seems. And so I'm not sure there's much you can do about that. And in that sense, the horse is already out of the barn. But with respect to future cables, future information, I think steps are going to be taken by the Department of State and other government departments to better limit the distribution of that material so you don't run the risk of another dump of 230,000 or whatever it was cables that happened recently, which is really an egregious occurrence.
But
egregious.
That's the upfront policy, and we can well imagine that that's already happening. But there is a power play on here, too. I mean, WikiLeaks put it out. I mean, there's a lot. I have to say there's a lot more to come. Horse may be out of the barn, but there's a lot more horse in there with all these cables. Things are going on under the covers right now and right out in public. Julian Assange is still, in effect, in custody in the U.K. I mean, you've got everybody from Dianne Feinstein, a Democrat, to Charles Krauthammer on the right saying, you know, throw the Espionage Act of 1917 at this guy. What troops would you marshal away from just policy about tightening up to try and clamp down on this, Ambassador?
Well, I mean, the judicial and legal process is going to play itself out, and I don't know where that's going to go. But from a policy point of view and from the point of view of diplomatic practice, we've got to restore some order in this situation. You can't run our business this way, the nation's business. And I think that there's a way of doing it systematically, legally, having proper declassification procedures. And I would be even willing to acknowledge the point that maybe there has been some overclassification of documents. Okay, well, let's address that. But still, there are certain minimum types of information that must be protected for a period of time as we carry out our diplomacy.
John Perry Barlow, you say human right to information. Ambassador Negroponte says got to restore some order here. You're predicting a radical escalation in this confrontation. What might that look like, John?
No, I will concede to the ambassador that one perhaps negative outfall from this is that internal government communications will be more circumspect, and I don't think that's in the people's interest. But, you know, I would differ with him strongly in terms of what is actually appropriate to keep secret from the people in a democracy and what isn't. I think that we have a classification system in this country that is, in fact, not even beneficial to the intelligence agencies. I mean, I've been doing consulting for the CIA and the NSA and various other parts of the American intelligence establishment since 1990, trying to get them to open up their processes so that they can actually figure out what the hell's going on. Most of the time, they can't vet information within themselves because of their classification. And most of the classification I've seen has been about trying to protect various institutional interests from public oversight.
Let's take it to our listeners. Burlington, Vermont. Ted, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. I just have three quick points to make. One is, this is frustrating to me because Mr. Negroponte, if you read the book Confessions of an Economic Hitman, your credibility with respect to transparency is totally shot because I can see why you'd want 20 and 30 years of basically paywalls around your information because if you look at that book, you know, war crimes are the kind of thing that you should be brought up on. And secondly, with respect to this whole issue, I wonder if Mr. Negroponte thinks that this kind of information should be censored from our troops, like Wall Street Journal just reported. I mean, when does censorship end? And if this is all just basically gossip, which basically it seems like it is, how do you have this kind of arraying of powers against a guy who basically released gossip? But and then Secretary Gates saying that the information doesn't mean anything. Well, if it doesn't mean anything, then why are we all going after this guy? So you have the Wall Street Journal censorship, and you have that issue, and I'd just like to hear anyone comment on that.
Ted, I appreciate your call. John Negroponte, you've got a tough in-the-trenches history behind you. Some people very unhappy about it. Others supported it. But there's John saying this is gossip, and you know what do you do now that it's out there? Pentagon, others saying don't even read this stuff, but it's out there. What would you do now?
Well, first, in response to the gentleman from Burlington, Vermont, since I was in government so long and the 25-year rule applies, you can actually see a lot of the material that I wrote after I entered the government in 1960. So there's at least 10 or 15 years' worth of stuff that's already out there in the public. There was a recent volume just published on Vietnam by the State Department where you can find material that was done by me, and there are other sources as well. So there's no cover-up, and certainly the Senate, when it confirmed me 9 different times for various positions in government, didn't feel that.
But if all those cables had been in public 20 years ago, in Honduras, around the Sandinistas, all the rest, would U.S. policy have taken the direction it took? Would reality be different today?
Well, I think it's, again, as my friends talked about serial truth-telling, what you see is what you get. I think you would have found a real correlation between the publicly stated policy and what you saw in the telegrams. I mean, I don't think this is a case of whistleblowing. It's not as if, and I think this is one of the fundamental problems in this discussion.
But you were saying in your cables back then, this must be secret. We must keep this secret. I mean, you were writing that.
But I think this is one of the fundamental problems in the discussion we're having right now. The mm-hmm. suggestion that just because you keep diplomatic communications and analyses about delicate country situations confidential, that it's somehow nefarious. It's not. It's protected for valid reasons.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about what's been called the world's first info war. If that's what it is, that's what it was. And what we just learned from the WikiLeaks confrontation. John Perry Barlow is with us, a founder of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, kind of cyber libertarian. He asserts there is a new human right, the right to know, and that it's a sort of war on cyberspace, government versus the freedom of cyberspace. Ambassador John Negroponte is with us as well. He was served all over in diplomatic service, was director of national intelligence from 05 to 07. And Fred Kate is with us from Indiana University, involved in all kinds of cybersecurity work, including classified work for the Pentagon. Chris in Buffalo, New York. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi. I'd just like to point out that in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, as penned by Eleanor Roosevelt after World War II, which is constantly trying to be implemented across the planet, there is the right to privacy is one of the articles. There is no right to know. That does not exist in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and I can just take a response on that off the air.
Chris, thanks for your call. John Perry Barlow, you hear that? Eleanor Roosevelt didn't write it. There is no right to know.
Well, neither did the founding fathers of the United States. In fact, there was no means to convey a right to know until now. I mean, this is the most remarkable thing about the Internet is that it does make it possible for everybody everywhere to have satisfaction to their curiosity within, I think, some reasonable limit. Now, I don't think that everybody has a right to know everything about everybody else individually, but I do think that they have a right to know to a very high degree the internal workings of their own government in a democracy. I mean, what we've found out as a result of WikiLeaks is that the whole damn government is don't ask, don't tell.
Do we have a right to know Muammar Gaddafi's traveling companion, maybe his sex partner? Is that something we have a right to know?
Well, I'd have to say that's probably his business, but...
it's in these leaked cables.
You know, I know that. But, I mean, I think that there is, you know, there is some responsibility on the part of the conventional media not to immediately leap on that aspect of things. I mean, I think that the conventional media have not shown a great deal of responsibility in their response to this information either.
And yet it's out there. It's out there in the big dump. Iowa City, Iowa. Nathan, you're on the air, Nathan.
Hi. I just had a comment to make, and then I'll ask for a reaction to it.
Okay.
Basically, my point was that Julian Assange is, I believe, not an American citizen.
Is not. That's correct.
Yeah, I was going to say he is pulling these things out, putting them on for everybody in the world to see. I would be less concerned if it was an American citizen. I'm not an overtly patriotic person. I'm not crazy about it or anything like that. But I would be less concerned if it was an American citizen saying we should be transparent within ourselves, but how can we trust the motivations of him or the other people who might be seeing this around the world? And like I said, I'll take my comments off the air.
Thank you, Nathan. That's an interesting question. John Negroponte, how do you interpret the motivation of Julian Assange and WikiLeaks?
I believe that whether it's he or whoever is working with him to selectively release this material are deliberately seeking to harm the conduct of American foreign relations. And I think the selections have been designed to maximize embarrassment. I think that seems to me to be the guiding principle. I doubt that they're going to immediately start releasing the stuff that makes us look the best. And we don't even look so bad with the ones they've chosen.
John Perry Barlow, I want to come to you again. You said right at the outset that we are in a real confrontation here between governments and the freedom of sort of the cyber realm. You said you're expecting radical escalation. I mean, there are already calls out there today for the hacker community to get more involved here. If there's radical escalation, what might that look like?
Well, first of all, I want to quickly address the caller's point, which is that Julian Assange may not be an American citizen, but he is a citizen. He is a person living on this planet, and as such is directly downstream from the actions of the most powerful nation on the planet. I think he certainly has a stake, just like everybody else, in the behavior of the United States government. And as far as the shape of the battle to come, I think first of all, what's important is assuring that this channel of opportunity for the truth to get out is not circumvented, and that we are capable of protecting it defensively from various governmental incursions, and as well as the many others like OpenLeaks and several others that are about to open up, in the future.
Another WikiLeaks style site?
Yes.
Okay. So what does that mean, the defenses for these things, the channel kept open? I mean, the United States seems quite determined that this not happen. There are big voices saying no. You know, put him in prison on espionage charges.
I think we can make it so that the only way to stop this information from being available is to shut down the Internet, which is not going to be very useful to anybody.
Explain that. The only way,
we can have material that is so widely distributed and so easily accessed from so many different places by so many different means that it's not going to be possible for the government to constrain the ability to access.
But if I could jump in there, Tom, I think one of the mistakes that the State Department made was to make a lot of this diplomatic reporting available on a Defense Department database called the CIPRNet. And there are ways of limiting the distribution of those communications so that they don't automatically get put on that database. And I'm sure, clearly to me, one of the things that's going to happen here is that the department's going to be more circumspect and more careful about the extent to which it circulates at least some of these diplomatic reports and analyses, but without prejudice to the circulation of any information, of course, that's relevant to law enforcement or terrorism information, has to be shared widely throughout our law enforcement and intelligence community.
But pull the curtain back a little further, John Negroponte. I mean, you were director of national intelligence. You know the full range of means available. John Perry Barlow is saying the only way you're going to stop this, and sure, you'd like to stop it at the front and all that, but it's the information age. The only way you're going to stop it is to shut down the Internet. Give us a fuller sense of the means you think a government like the United States has to go after this kind of leaking, which we may see a lot more of. What are the means?
Well, look, first of all, it'd be ludicrous to try and shut down the Internet. We live in the information age, as you said, and we live in the Internet age, and we all have to accept that. I think the way you have to go about it is to control the dissemination of information before it actually gets onto this vehicle. And you have to decide. You can tag cables. You can tag information. You can tag intelligence reports in such a way that it restricts their distribution.
Right. So upfront control.
And certain really sensitive stuff.
Yeah.
Certain really sensitive stuff you can handle in such a way that it's just manually carried around offices in Washington. We have that kind of situation. But
you got a whole world to deal with. What else? After that first line, and that would be stop it at the get-go, but that's not fail-safe. How do you go after Julian Assange, WikiLeaks, if he should be gone after?
I think first and foremost, you have to go after people within our own government, the people who actually carry out the leaks, people over whom we have both jurisdiction and who normally have signed confidentiality agreements promising to handle that material in a certain way. They're the ones who initially violated the trust that was conferred upon them. Mr. Assange is somewhat down the line there, and we'll see how that process plays out. I gather the Justice Department is looking into the possibility of a prosecution. I don't want to get out in front of our Justice Department on a question like that.
But once it's out of the gate, once it's beyond, U.S. government employees or staffers, and it's out there in the world.
It gets progressively harder, obviously.
What are your means then?
Well, I'm not entirely certain. I think it's problematic. It obviously has been. This stuff continues to be published periodically. Every day stuff comes out. And in a lot of different countries, there's material being published that we're not even, that mindful of here, but which are complicating relationships in the various countries concerned.
Fred Kate, how do you see the means on the state side of this confrontation, if that's what it is? I mean, in terms of keeping it secure in the first place, and once the information's out there, what's the range of, armaments in this realm?
Well, two critical issues here, Tom. One is the keeping it secure to begin with is certainly where the U.S. has the greatest number of resources. But I actually think it's going to be harder than the ambassador suggests to separate between the information that needs to be shared and the information that doesn't need to be shared. If there's been one chorus since 9/11, including the 9/11 Commission, it's been that we need to do a better job sharing information. And, of course, it was the ambassador's responsibility to be the first post-9/11 head of national intelligence to carry that out. But it's still proving quite difficult, and especially when you reach down to the state level, local law enforcement, and so forth. So the reaction, particularly in the White House, where the president has said we're going to share less information if we can't secure it better, frankly, that could be the biggest dangerous impact of this if it means the U.S. doesn't have the information it needs to defend itself. The point about what do you do once the information's out, to be perfectly honest, the answer is there is nothing that a country can do to effectively block access to the information. The internet is an environment in which, because information can be so easily mirrored, put on different sites, that it's a little like playing whack-a-mole. You can go around taking a swing at each site you find it on, but there are millions of sites, and it's simply beyond the capacity of this government or, frankly, any other to effectively put an end to information online. As I think we've seen by the sort of silly memoranda that have come out saying, don't read these memos, when the government's reduced to that type of approach, I think we know the battle's over.
But the information is out there. John Perry Barlow, I want to come to you on this, but a couple of calls first. Terry in Shrewsbury, Massachusetts. Terry, you're on the air.
Well, sir, first I want to say thank you for this conversation. I think it's wonderful. But I have to disagree with some of the calls that I've heard coming in. I don't agree that it's an automatic inalienable right for people to get a hold of this information. I think that someone like Julian Assange has threatened things such as political issues abroad. He could be threatening things that we don't even know are going on in terms of operations for the country. I think that's for the politicians and the professionals to decide.
You don't want to know what's going on, Terry, in that case?
I don't think it's necessarily good for the country for us to know that in depth what's going on.
Terry, our time is short. I appreciate your call. One more right here from New Jersey. Egg Harbor, New Jersey. I'll come to you, John. Craig in Egg Harbor.
Yes, very briefly. I think it's naive to think there are no repercussions. For example, in the case of Yemen, the president there, his cover was blown, and we no longer have the ability to target terrorists and terrorist camps because of this leak that happened. Thanks. I'll take my answer off the air.
Craig, I appreciate that. And and one more here. Mike, Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Mike, you're on.
There are many things we need to keep secret as a country and everything, but at the same time, I believe that the Constitution, without quoting it directly, read something along the line that we're supposed to be a government for the people and governed by the people. And I mean, there's much information that's not even shared with us that I think needs to be.
Mike, I appreciate your call. John Perry Barlow, you're listening here. I mean, there's this range of reactions across the board from, you know, need to know, don't need to know, and then this range of assessments of where this thing stands. I mean, Ambassador Negroponte wants to clamp down on the information in the first place. You're saying the only way to stop this is to shut down the internet. He's saying can't do that. Where does this go?
Well, I'm really concerned about these calls, and I'm concerned about the fact that almost 70% of the people in the United States seem to think that this is a violation of our national interest. I can't, you know, I have a hard time thinking that knowing more about what your government is doing is a violation of the national interest. I think an informed populace is absolutely essential to a democracy. And what I'm hearing in these last calls is the support of don't want to know.
Well, one of them anyway, yeah.
And I think that this does not speak well for the American people and their chances to go on conducting a democracy. I'm also gravely concerned about what's going to happen as the government tries to come up with something to support the voters' view that Julian Assange should be prosecuted. As far as I can tell, he has not broken any laws.
Dianne Feinstein says throw the Espionage Act at him from 1917.
Well, the Espionage Act was thought to be unconstitutional at the time that it was passed in 1917. And if they invoke that, it's going to be injurious to the First Amendment gravely, and it's going to create a factionalization of this country and a war between two ways of looking at things is going to be very, very bad for the conduct of civilized democracy in America.
Are hackers potent in that confrontation if it should come?
They certainly will be.
John Negroponte, I don't know where this goes. I mean, and John Perry Barlow just have opposite views of what should go on.
Let me make three, if I could, make three quick points. First, I mean, there is a principle, and it's been long established, about the handling of classified information called need to know, and that's a very good principle. You get the information and access to it if you really need to know it to carry out your job. Secondly, As far as distribution of information is concerned for counterterrorism and all those purposes, when I was director of national intelligence, we empowered the National Counterterrorism Center with databases from 26 different agencies. It was pouring in there 7x24, and that's where we brought together and integrated all the on a real-time basis all the counterterrorism information that we needed.
But quietly, not publicly.
And that system works very well. And last point, you know, we haven't in the whole hour that we've been talking, we talk about the right of people to have access to information. Nobody's mentioned the United States Congress. We have a representative form of government here. And there's certain things that if they're classified but require oversight by the American people, we do it through our Congress. They're cleared for this material. And we spent a lot of time testifying before the Congress explaining all of these kinds of situations. So that's another way in which the interests of the American people are protected.
Yeah, I think you said it. There is law. And there is now another view as well about what human rights are here when it comes to information. Fred Kate, very quickly, who wins this thing? Who wins?
Well, in the long run, there's no question the information's out there. It's not going to be brought back, and I suspect we'll see even more information in the future.
This has been really interesting. Fred Kate at Indiana University. Thanks, Fred, for joining us.
Thank you.
John Negroponte, thank you, sir, for being here today.
Pleasure.
John Perry Barlow, thanks.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.